Good morning. It's good to see you. So, I made a switch with Matt. I was supposed to worship lead last Sunday, but I was in Saskatchewan, so I agreed to do the sermon the day after we got back. So, here we go. I wrote this mostly between Sault Ste. Marie and Sudbury yesterday, although after much thought, I did some research in Drake, Saskatchewan, and talked to a bunch of people about what I should say, about name, and but this was kind of written between Sault Ste. Marie and Sudbury. So it's kind of written as a bit of a letter. Here, let's start. Dear HMC, I'm writing this sermon on the last leg of our road trip to Saskatchewan. So you may find that it contains bits of prairie grass and Lake Superior water in it, or hair, feathers, or scales from any of the flocks of pelicans, four bears, three prairie dogs, or the one sandhill crane we saw on our travels. And we also saw a painted turtle. Leaving Sault Ste. Marie this morning, I already missed the Superior Highlands. We'll have to return someday. We visited my parents in Lanigan, and I'm so grateful for Karen and Jen, who traveled 4 days each way in our little Honda Fit with our dog Sammy to spend time with them. We had some adventures. In spite of all that bombards her in terms of social media and the pressures of the world, Jen recognizes the value of hugs from Grandma and Grandpa. My dad is in long-term care. He's an author, but he doesn't write so much now. My mom was a great cook, but now that she's on her own, she doesn't make the large meals she's famous for. And in the eyes of the world, they may be simply common people, but God has made them very important, not only to my sister and me, but now to our extended families. And I have the first of four photos here to show you. That's us in the Watson restaurant, and my mom and dad and my sister and her boys, Alan and Paul, and there's Jen and me and Karen, and we spent a great time together. So, whenever I go to Saskatchewan to see my parents, I encounter a flood of memories, some great, some not so great. As I was preparing for this sermon, I was reminded, and as I attended Drake North Star Mennonite Church last Sunday, I was reminded of my years in Sunday school and of the lessons I was taught. Looking back, I'm now kind of frustrated by the way we often tell the stories of biblical heroes. Stories are packaged in very condensed form, and sometimes there's a good reason for that. But the other side of these simplified tellings is that we don't get to hear everyone's story. Bible heroes are often oversimplified and sometimes hyper-masculinized until we wind up with biblical He-Man action figures whose perceived strength and personal fortitude appear to save the day. Next slide. There we go. We've got David and Noah and Moses and Samson, and these are the G.I. Joe series of biblical heroes. And Naaman, the next slide, is sometimes portrayed, you know, as this mighty, and he was a warrior, but sometimes his personal strength and fortitude are kind of overshadow all the rest of the story. But his story also challenges this emphasis on physical strength and personal fortitude. 2 Kings 5 tells the story of a reluctant warrior who's very hesitant to follow God's instructions, but then he eventually changes his mind, bathes in the Jordan, and is healed. If you really look at the chapter, however, the bathing and healing only takes up one verse. There's so much more here than is captured by the usual telling, and so much more for us to think about. I want to point out a couple of things as I talk here. My first point is that God works wonders through people we may at first overlook or whom we may consider to be common. The term servant appears in various forms, and if you look at various editions, versions of the Bible, 13 times throughout this chapter. This shouldn't be a surprise because the Bible is full of such stories if we really pay attention. So my first point is God works through anyone God chooses, regardless of earthly power or status. One of the stops on our trip was at the Terry Fox Memorial overlooking Lake Superior, and here is a photo of Karen and Sammy at the memorial. Unfortunately, Sammy mistook the statue for a giant and began to bark furiously at it. One of those great family moments, national hero, and our little dog is yapping at Terry. Terry is celebrated nationwide as an ordinary person who, through his determination, launched a campaign to fund cancer research and, by the time of his death, had raised $24 million for this cause. In 1999, a national survey named him as Canada's greatest hero. In the words of his mother and former basketball coach, Terry was an average guy. Only his determination made him unique. But an article by Margaret McCaffrey and Terry Murphy, published at the time of his death in Canadian Family Physician, warned that in the excessive media coverage, the hour-by-hour updates of his eventual decline and death, we have made Terry a Canadian saint, and in doing so, we have robbed him of his ordinariness. Let's not put Terry Fox and his like beyond our reach, because who knows, we may want to reach that far again sometime. We need to remember that great things can occur through any one of us, not only due to personal fortitude, but due to the empowering spirit of God in our lives. By the way, on our trip, Sammy kind of became a photo hog, so, you know, by the great Wawa Goose, the Dryden Moose, the Wimit Canyon, it became all about Sammy. Okay. So, that's enough for the photos. You can turn that off. Thank you. My second point is this. God does not conform to our expectations for storytelling, and to our narrative plot devices. Heroes turn out to have serious flaws, servants can do good or evil, kings and rulers can be deathly afraid. God's narrative involves plot twists and surprises, or as I've entitled the sermon, unexpected moments of grace. So the story has a number of plot twists that beg us to pay attention, and I'll begin to dig into them now. The first plot twist, Naaman is often portrayed as a central character, but a hero with a serious flaw. Even though the term leprosy refers to a range of dermatological conditions, we can assume that Naaman's leprosy may have left him in a physically painful and socially awkward situation, to say the least. This was something he really didn't want, the one thing that plagued his life. He was desperate to be healed, but he was powerless to do anything about it. A second plot twist occurs right away. God's words of direction come not from Naaman or from any other military or political leader, but from an apparently powerless Israelite girl who had been captured by the Syrian army. The girl, a servant to Naaman's wife, directs Naaman to the prophet Elisha, a servant of the living God, probably demonstrating considerable bravery in speaking up at this point. The powerful suffer, the powerless speak words of wisdom. Reminded of the words of Jean Vanier, a relatively humble man of privileged upbringing who left his careers in the Navy and academia to welcome two men with disabilities to live with him. Vanier didn't see himself a hero for doing this, but rather as a channel of God's grace. He gave credit to Philippe and Raphael for their bravery in coming to live with him and for revealing God to him in their lives. Through this openness to God's leadership, the L'Arche communities are now established in over 20 countries around the world. Hope and strength come through those we often deem to be the least powerful in our society. Back to the story. The next plot twist. As a result of the girl's suggestion, Naaman gets a Syrian king to send him with a letter to the Israeli king, asking to be healed. I haven't seen many political leaders transcend their pride to openly humiliate themselves, but the king of Israel tears up his clothes. As a powerful political leader, he's powerless to fulfill the directions Naaman has conveyed. Enter Elisha. O king, what have you done with your nice clothes? They're all in rags around your feet. Just send Naaman to me. So Naaman, the great warrior, who by the way is loaded down with great riches, goes to Elisha's house. But Elisha isn't there. So somehow I'm envisioning a limo pulling up to perhaps an important house of a political leader, and only the servant greets them, I'm full of Harry Potter references today, coming to see Harry and Dobby the house elf answers the door. I don't know. Expected to be greeted with greatness, I'm a rich warrior, I've come to pay for my healing, you must be the great prophet Elisha. Naaman is instead greeted by, guess what? A servant. And the servant has a message, go and bathe in the muddy Jordan River. What? No pomp and ceremony, no wave of a wand, mysterious incantations, told Joes in Harry Potter. Mirthlap essence, or dittany, or abyssor, or phoenix tears, none of that. No, this is a go and do it yourself. No audience except for Naaman's own soldiers, no bolt of lightning from the sky. Here Naaman complains, and I think I would have done the same thing. did a little bit of research on the Jordan, and it's a muddy river, maybe because it winds a lot and picks up silt from the riverbank on its way. But it's not perhaps the nicest place to go and take a bath. But it's notable because it was here in the Jordan that John would later baptize Jesus. And Naaman's references to the great rivers of Damascus isn't just a bout of homesickness. The Abana and the Pharpar were the reason for the lush and fertile plains of Damascus. Naaman's response might be interpreted as, "This prophet won't even come to meet me. He sends his servant and tells me to go bathe myself in the river. Things were better back home." So guess who persuades Naaman to follow Elisha's instructions? Servants. It was the servants again. "Just go and do what they said. It might be a yucky cure, but why not?" And maybe the servants were tired of Naaman's pride. I'm assuming that they may have had to do equally unappealing things given their social status, and why not just get it over with? Naaman's healing only takes one verse, and that's verse 14, which is read already. I find the rest of the chapter to be interesting, and even more interesting than this verse about his healing. Naaman offers to pay for his cure because he assumes that this would be the proper transaction, or to show off his status as a warrior and the wealth of the Syrian king. Elisha refuses his payment. This healing was not bought with earthly treasures. It had not come from Elisha. Instead, it is a gift from God, one not necessarily deserved, but one which is given freely by a God who says, "Turn to me, listen to my voice, even if it comes from someone you were not expecting." But the chapter doesn't end here. Naaman then says, "Hey, give me 2 mule loads of earth so I can go back to my home country and still worship the God who healed me." There's an association between place and worship, and this is one which Jesus will overcome by extending his salvation beyond the limits of the Israelites. Jesus would later refer to Naaman as an outsider to the Jewish people through whom God worked a miracle. Naaman then makes a request that I'm still trying to figure out. "I will worship the God who healed me, but please let me accompany my master to the temple of Rimmon." This is the only time Rimmon appears in the Bible, but some sources translate Rimmon as Baal, which is really, it's a complication. The story doesn't end neatly. Elisha says, "Go in peace." It's not necessarily a go ahead, but it's rather, you'll have to figure these things out as you go. Naaman's story does not necessarily have a tidy ending. So God works through whomever God chooses. Most of the action in this chapter occurs through servants, and the last part of the chapter is no exception. But this time the servant does wrong. Gehazi, Elisha's servant, hears that Elisha has not taken any payment for the healing. He races after Naaman, comes up with the story that 2 sons of the prophets have come to visit Elisha. "I know that Elisha turned down your offer of money and gifts, but the things have changed. We'd really be grateful for some new outfits and some money to give to them." Naaman obliges, and Gehazi returns, and Elisha confronts Gehazi. "Where have you been?" Gehazi says, "Nowhere." Elisha says, "Don't lie to me. I know that you've chased after Naaman for some of his wealth, even after I was clear that we shouldn't take any." Gehazi replies, "It really wasn't that much. Naaman has lots of money and nice clothing. He brought these things to show his gratitude." Elisha may have said, "God has healed this man, not us. You can't buy God's healing or love. You've defiled God with your greed. For this, you and your descendants forever will suffer from leprosy." This seems like a harsh punishment. Naaman had a lot of wealth. And Elisha seems to have a bit of an edge. I discussed this with a pastor at Drake last week who said, "Well, sin is sin." But it's another example of how the story doesn't have a tidy ending. So, where does this all leave us? Return to my 2 points. 1, God speaks through whomever will listen. It wasn't Naaman's military power that saved the day, but rather God's mercy. God spoke not only through his prophet Elisha, but through servants who appear to be powerless by our societal standards. 2, God doesn't obey our narrative structures. Heroes have serious flaws. Not all servants are good. Pride can grip both kings and servants. Powerful kings can tremble at the knees. Throughout this chapter, God is merciful, healing those who humble themselves and who ask God for healing. Let us do the same. Amen. Grace and peace to you. Signing off from Northern Ontario, Tim Abbott.